In 2010, one of our country's leading environmentalists, Bill McKibben, was devastated by a lack of political leadership on climate change. He wrote a piece with a title that's not fit for radio, and that piece ended with these words. Mostly we need to tell the truth, resolutely and constantly. Fossil fuel is wrecking the one Earth we've got. It's not going to go away because we ask politely. If we want a world that works, we're going to have to raise our voices. Since then, McKibben is still organizing, writing, and raising his voice. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be keeping you company today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1988, McKibben wrote The End of Nature. It was the first book for a general audience about global warming. He is the co-founder and chairman of 350.org, an international climate change campaign, and Foreign Policy magazine named him one of the 100 most important global thinkers. He recently edited The Global Warming Reader, a century of writing about climate change. And we're happy to take your questions and comments for Bill McKibben this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also keep the conversation going on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Bill McKibben, I'm happy to have you with us today.
Veronica, what a pleasure.
Well, in 2010, you were really mad about the failure of the environmental lobby to get any traction with legislation on Capitol Hill, and you were mad at Obama for not driving climate change legislation. And since then, what's changed? How are you feeling these days?
I'm afraid I'm just perpetually annoyed, you know. what's changed is the science has gotten darker, and we've had 2 years of the most extreme weather anyone's ever seen on this continent and around the world. Last year, the U.S. set a record for most multi-billion dollar weather disasters. This year, we've been setting every kind of bizarre record. You guys got some of the that March heat that rewrote the record books across the United States.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, certainly no progress on Capitol Hill. The president's managed to increase automobile mileage requirements, which over time will help some. And the probably most important news is that a kind of more determined movement has arisen, and I think the best evidence of that probably is the fight to stop this Keystone Pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada, which turned into the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years on any issue in this country, and so far anyway has managed to win a small and temporary victory over the oil industry. And nobody's done anything that's going to come close to stopping or even slowing down climate change yet, but the movement to try and do that is building, and that's probably the most significant development of recent years.
And you've been a big part of that movement. I know that it's a grassroots effort, but you've been part of it. And I want to talk to you about that, because I've read that you had an epiphany one day about organizing. You'd kind of seen yourself as a guy who tells the truth, who gets the word out and leaves it to other people to build that movement. But at a certain point, you thought, maybe I'm the guy who's supposed to build the movement, right?
Well, or at least to help a little bit. Epiphany. I came back from a trip to Bangladesh once, not that long ago, 5, 6, 7 years ago, and you know, Bangladesh under assault from climate change in many ways, but they were having the acute problem at the moment of their first big outbreak of dengue fever, a mosquito-borne disease that's now spreading like wildfire across Asia and South America, and in fact, I'd gotten bitten by the wrong mosquito. It was as sick as I'd ever been, but I didn't die, obviously, because I was strong and healthy going in. A lot of people were dying, and the thing that kept striking me as I was in the clinics and things was how unfair this is. You can't even measure how much carbon 140 million people in Bangladesh produce. It's a rounding error, you know. And back home, the 4% of us who live here, historically, we've contributed about a third of the global warming gases in the atmosphere. We burn so much coal and gas and oil. So, at a certain point, I guess I did feel like it wasn't enough to be writing only about this. And we've built this 350.org movement, the first big global grassroots climate change movement, and it's gotten big and getting bigger all over the planet, and that's, I guess, you know, my small part in trying to help here.
Well, tell us about 350.org. How was that born?
350 is the most important number in the world, although no one knew it until about 4 years ago when Jim Hansen at NASA in January of 2008, he and his team published a paper saying, you know, we know enough about carbon now to know how much is too much. Any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Now, that's strong language, obviously. And it's stronger still if you know that, you know, wherever you are today, Milwaukee or Moscow, you know, the atmosphere is 393 parts per million CO2. So we're already way too high, and we're climbing 2 parts per million per year. So the reason we chose that name for this movement is not because you'd normally want to organize around a wonky scientific data point, but because Arabic numerals cross linguistic boundaries, and it allows you to organize around the globe, and indeed we have. We've, you know, conducted about 15,000 demonstrations now in the last 4 years in every country on Earth except North Korea. It's turned into what CNN called the most widespread political activity in the planet's history, and that's good. This is the first truly global problem we've ever faced, so the response inevitably is going to have to include everyone.
Well, I've read that group has been active in 188 countries, and in fact, some journalists have pointed out that the Occupy movement could take a page out of the book of 350.org.
Well, and you know, we work actually with the Occupy movement because, and we can take a page from them because the analysis in certain ways is much the same. I mean, the problem that we really face with global warming, above all, the thing that makes it so intractable is that the fossil fuel industry, which is the 1% of the 1%, the richest industry on Earth, it uses that money to block political change. They've been able to warp our democracies so that we've effectively had a 20-year bipartisan strategy in Washington of doing nothing about global warming. And so the focus on that kind of how to control corporate, financial, and political power is very much a part of this fight. And that's why we've worked easily with Occupy, along with many others, you know, with faith communities all over the world and with farmers and peasant farmers and, you know, just with just about everybody you can name, you know, except those people who run the coal and oil industries who don't much like us.
So can you talk a little bit more about why there has been so little done at the legislative level about climate change? Is it just a lack of political will, or is it that the constituents aren't driving it? They're just not getting it somehow?
Here's the essential problem, the thing that makes it so hard. Fossil fuel is the most profitable industry on Earth, and the reason is that they're the only industry on the planet that doesn't have to take out their trash, as it were. Everybody else has to clean up after themselves. If you run a restaurant in Madison, you know, the cheapest way for you to deal with your garbage at the end of the day would just to be to shovel it out in the street. But we don't let them do that because otherwise, you know, Madison would be overrun with rats and we'd get leptospirosis or something. The only exception to that rule is the fossil fuel industry, and they get to pour their carbon into the atmosphere for free. That's their business model. It's why they're so profitable, and it's why they are so militant about protecting that. And until we can overcome that, the chances for other kinds of energy to make a huge, significant leap to the kind of forefront of our energy mix are kind of small. Now, that's tied up with, you know, constituents, even all of us are kind of used to fossil fuel and like having cheap fossil fuel around and things like that. But we can deal with some of those issues. The real problem is just that brute power that comes with that money in the fossil fuel industry. And to that, since we'll never match them with money, we're going to have to build movements.
Well, you just edited this new book, The Global Warming Reader, and you've got essays in here. You've got hard science pieces, a selection from Al Gore. There's a piece by Arundhati Roy, a couple from you, of course. And you say that part of the goal here is to fill in the gaps where people are still a little fuzzy on the whole climate change thing. It's been quite a while. I mean, you wrote that first book in 88. Why do you think people are still, why are there still these holes in people's knowledge?
Well, you know, I got to say, this has not been one of the issues in which journalism has covered itself with glory. For the first 4 or 5 years, you know, in the early 1990s, it was a perfectly useful exercise to write a lot of stories about, is this true or not, and do scientists believe it and things, and because scientists were going about the work of figuring out whether it was true. By 1995 or so, that job was essentially done, and the world's academies of science and, you know, all the other kind of bodies of science have said, yes, humans are heating the planet. It is a very serious problem. We best get to it. But unfortunately, you know, because journalism sort of enjoys the controversy above consensus, the 0.25% of dissenting scientists are treated as if they're the equivalent of the heavy weight of scientific opinion, and so people have been left with a little bit of general confusion. Now, in that reader, I made it a point of putting in a couple of pieces from prominent skeptics about climate change, Senator Imhoff from Oklahoma, say. That's because we deserve a historical record as time goes on to remind us of why we didn't take action. But I do think that people are catching on finally. The polling data, even in the last few months, have been released a series of big polls that show that the number of Americans concerned about climate change has jumped dramatically in the last few years. And the reason is, and this is really important, the reason is that it's no longer scientists or journalists that they're relying on to figure it out. It's the evidence of their own eyes. The link to extreme and bizarre weather is what's now convincing people. And I mean, think about that heat wave in March across the Midwest and the East. I mean, a heat wave that had temperature, you know, it was 94 degrees in South Dakota 2 days before the end of winter. Every fruit tree across, you know, Michigan in bloom. We had places where the low temperature for the day beat the previous high temperature record for that day. Things that just statistically should be impossible. Now, I live in the north. Everybody kind of enjoyed it, like walking around in their shorts, you know, in the middle of March. But everybody who was thinking, and I think most people now, also had a kind of small voice in the back of their head saying, you know what, this is not supposed to be like this.
Yeah.
Wisconsin in the middle of March.
Yeah, it did feel eerie. I remember being at the bus stop and having conversations going, yeah, this is nice, but I'm a little freaked out by it. It just felt a little strange.
Well, and it was more than a little strange, and it's the kind of thing that's happening around the planet. And, you know, I mean, we see it more dramatically. The thing that's most dramatic that's going on rests on the simple fact that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. The atmosphere is about 4% wetter than it used to be. And that means that the dice are really loaded for drought and for flood. And we're seeing more of both of them. And you know, you just passed a certain point. People just understand that and catch on. I don't think people yet truly understand just how widespread this is. Next weekend at 350.org, we're holding this big global day that we're calling Connect the Dots. And the point of it is to make sure that people around the world who have suffered through one thing or another are able to witness to that and remind us all that these droughts, these floods, these changes are not one-off tragedies, that they're absolutely connected. You know, and there'll be good stuff going on, you know, in Wisconsin. 9:30 on May 5th, down at that amazing farmer's market in Madison, down at the Children's Museum, a kind of teaching about what's going on with climate change and farmers across the Midwest, and there'll be things in Eau Claire and Milwaukee and Stevens Point and Kenosha and on and on and on. People go to 350.org or climatedots.org. They'll find out. It's going to be a very powerful day. I mean, it'll begin in the Marshall Islands where the sun rises first on the planet with some of our friends there underwater filming on the coral reef that's dying as the oceans acidify. And it'll continue, you know, around the globe as the sun moves around the globe with thousands of actions from people who have been, I mean, some of them by this point, I think some of them will be kind of edgy and a little angry. Pakistan has had 2 years now of record flooding with, in each case, millions of people pushed from their homes. There's a limit to how many times you can do that. It just becomes impossible past a certain point, and people are tired of it, especially since in a place like Pakistan, you know, they really have done very little to cause the problem.
I want to ask you, last night I came across a piece about James Lovelock, who came up with the Gaia theory.
Yes.
And the main thrust of the piece was that he was backpedaling a little about his extreme predictions about climate change,
God,
saying it just wasn't happening that fast, according to him. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, thank heaven he's backpedaling some, because his predictions were
they were pretty dire.
Crazy. I mean, he had said 2 years ago, he said by, you know, by the middle of the century or something, there'll only be 100 million humans left, and they'll all be living at the North Pole.
Breeding pairs, I think you call them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know what? I've spent a long time worrying about climate change, but this is pretty extreme stuff, and I'm glad he's realized that it's pretty extreme stuff. What's happening is bad enough, more than bad enough. It's by far the biggest thing humans have ever engaged in, without having to, you know, add science fiction to the list of our worries.
Well, our guest this hour is Bill McKibben, one of our country's leading environmentalists. He is the co-founder of the organization 350.org, an international climate campaign that works in 188 countries around the world. And this hour we're talking about his new book that he's edited called The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change, which was published at the end of March. And we're happy to take your questions and comments for Bill McKibben this hour. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can reach us by email at talk@WPR.org, or keep the conversation going on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Help us make One Day Wednesday a success by making your gift early. 500 early pledges, that's the magic number. So give now and track our progress at WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with our guest Bill McKibben, who is one of our country's leading environmentalists. Time magazine called him the world's best green journalist, and he's got a new book out. He's edited the book called The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change. And we go to our phone lines now. We've got Ned joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Ned.
Hi. I have a couple of comments. First, a couple of years ago, we had a movement that, including 350.org, that was promoting a decline of 2% per year over 40 years of carbon emissions that would reach our goal of 80% by 2050. And I was part of the marches that were promoting that, and the last couple of years I haven't heard as much about that as I did about 2010, 2009, back in that time frame. And so an update on that. My second comment is I'm joining a group right now, trying to form a group in Stevens Point area called the Citizen Climate Lobby. Citizen Climate Lobby.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ned. And Bill.
Yes. So the first part of the question is, I think one of the things we've sort of come to understand in the last couple of years, the science has been guiding us to sort of understand that thinking about 2050 in a certain sense maybe is very important, but thinking about sort of 2020 may be more important. Things are happening very quickly, and we have to get off the dime right away. The Citizens Climate Lobby that he refers to is a very useful operation. It's thinking about kind of the most politically plausible way to put a price on carbon. I mean, the problem with doing it is obvious. People don't want to pay more for their gasoline because, you know, we're kind of broke. But we have to pay more for it because we have to send that strong signal that we got to stop using it in the quantities that we do. So the way around it is an interesting proposal that now is gaining some traction, a version just adopted in Australia. You put a big, heavy tax on coal and gas and oil. You collect it at the mine gate or the wellhead or whatever. Exxon then runs up the price of gas at the pump a lot, which is good. It reminds you when you pay it that you really don't need a semi-military vehicle to go to the grocery store in, you know. But instead of just sending that money off to Washington, you would write a check to everybody in the country every month or every 6 months or whatever for their share. The theory being that if the sky belongs to anyone, it belongs to us, not Exxon. And this would make people whole against that increase in price. You know, most Americans would come out ahead. Not if you own a Learjet, you know, then you use so much energy that you'd come out behind. But you should come out behind because at this point, owning a Learjet's a pretty antisocial thing to do.
Bill, you said they're doing some of that in Australia now?
Yes, they just passed the Australian Senate a version of this, not quite as clean as the one that I described. Things rarely emerge from our parliaments and congresses in quite the clean form that one might want. But it's a start, and there's also a kind of version of it in British Columbia, too. So there are some experiments beginning at the edges, not yet on a scale that's going to make a telling difference, but, you know, it's ramping up.
Can you give us a sense of how the U.S. stacks up against other countries in terms of legislation?
Well, let's talk first in terms of emissions. We're the world champions. We've poured the most carbon into the atmosphere by far of anyone over the last century. Now the Chinese, as a country, produce more than we do each year as of a couple of years ago, but of course there's four times as many of them. In terms of legislation, there's we're the whatever the opposite of champion is. We're the one among the many cellar dwellers who have done very, very little to deal with this problem. At the moment, of course, nothing can get through Congress that would seriously address it, and so the Obama administration has done some of the things it could by administrative action, new regulations about coal-fired power plants and things. They've also, unfortunately, opened a lot of new land to coal mining and oil drilling and stuff, which is counterproductive. I mean, you know, they opened a huge new swath of Wyoming to federal land to coal mining, and that was the equivalent of opening 300 new coal-fired power plants. Hmm. So it's, you know, there's we've one step forward, one step back. But I was very heartened to note the day before yesterday that the president said, we're going to talk more about climate change in this election. I understand people's frustration. And the reason I was heartened to say that is not because, you know, having Barack Obama talk about climate change is going to solve the problem, but because, as with all politicians, these guys pay great attention to the public mood. If they think it's to their advantage to talk about climate change, it's a signal that their polling and everything else indicates what I've been telling you, that people are more and more and more attuned to this question.
Well, let's go back to the phones now. We've got Hugh joining us next from Milwaukee. Hi there, Hugh.
Hi. If you ever see a BBC production of History of Britain, it starts out with what people were eating in the ruins of the islands off of Scotland, way in the north, and they were eating tropical fish. And they were eating tropical fish because at that time it was much warmer than it is today. In the Middle Ages, the French complained about the competition from English wine. And the English were growing grapes because it was much warmer than it is today. Greenland had cows grazing on the lands of the Green Land. They had enough European population for bishop because it was much warmer than it is today. There's natural fluctuation. About a century and a half ago, the East River flows over and people from Manhattan could walk to Brooklyn. It can get colder and warmer. These are natural fluctuations before there were automobiles, before man allegedly changed the climate.
Yes, totally.
The notion that we should go back to whale oil or something is just horrendous.
Hugh, I'm going to break in here so we can, I hear Bill trying to answer your question. Go ahead, Bill, and thank you, Hugh.
So first of all, I'm in complete agreement with you. Going back to whale oil would be disastrous in many ways, including the fact that we're almost entirely out of whales, and it wouldn't work very well. There have been big fluctuations, much bigger than the one Hugh describes, in weather over time. I mean, it's worth remembering that, at a certain point, Wisconsin was under a mile of ice, and at a certain other point, we had dinosaurs on this planet, and so on and so forth. We have very large changes in climate over time. We know what drives, what's driven, say, ice ages in the past. We can, the Milankovitch cycles and the eccentricities in the orbit and tilt and wobble of the planet lead to more and less solar accumulation over time, and over deep time that can drive things like ice ages. What's different now, and the reason that scientists is in every scientific body you can name are sounding the alarm, is that we're introducing a new force into this. We have dug up hundreds of millions of years worth of biology and tossed it into the air all at once, all those old ferns and dinosaurs and plankton and other things that turned into oil and coal. And it's not, it's not some kind of strange, novel theory. We've known for 100 years that the molecular structure of that carbon dioxide that results traps heat near the planet. That's why the planet, we have a nice temperate planet in between Mars and Venus, because we had a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Now we've got half again as much as we did when the Industrial Revolution began, and that's why the temperature has risen a degree globally, not just, there have always been changes in, there'll be a warm spell across a certain part of the globe or something like that, but this is happening all over the planet. And you can tell by just looking at the most gross measures of things. 40% less sea ice in the summer Arctic. Chemistry of the ocean changed to the degree that it's about 30% more acid. That 4% increase in moisture in the atmosphere, which is a staggering change in a baseline physical phenomenon. The most interesting thing that's happened in our lifetimes is that we have left behind the Holocene, this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that underwrote the rise of human civilization. And now we're in something new. It doesn't really have a name yet.
Some people are calling it Anthropocene.
The Anthropocene, that's right, the sort of world made by man. The question is how far into it we're going to go. Having raised the temperature 1 degree, the same climatologists who told us that was going to happen now tell us that unless we get off coal and gas and oil very, very quickly, we're going to raise the temperature 4 or 5 degrees. And the implications of that are so staggering that we best not talk about them at this early hour in the morning.
You're right that if people could just feel what was happening and really feel it in their bones, that everyone would be shouting at the top of their lungs. So why isn't that happening? Why? I mean, it is happening. The movement is growing, but I guess it's taken a while. And what is it going to take to get that feeling that you're sensing it in your bones going on for everybody?
I don't really know. And that's what we keep working toward. I do think it's growing. I do think it's quite remarkable that it's growing, given the resources that the fossil fuel industry has poured into kind of constant disinformation. But at a certain point, we will cross that tipping point. Just like at a certain point, you know, nobody was calling in anymore and saying that smoking really wasn't a problem. Everybody, even smokers, especially smokers, understood that, boy, they would really like to be able to quit, you know. We'd really like to be able to quit fossil fuel. It's not easy to do. It won't be easy. It'll be the hardest thing we've ever done. The only thing that'd be harder is not quitting and trying to deal with the world that will result if we don't.
Let's take another phone call now. Dan is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Veronica. Good show. I was wondering what the right, when it says that global climate change is a hoax, do they mean it's a lie, a conspiracy, a joke? Are there any Republicans or right, people on the right, who actually are coming to realize that it's not a hoax? And are we a force of nature?
So that's the second question. The answer is easy now. Yes, we are a force of nature. We pour endlessly more carbon into the atmosphere, say, than volcanoes do. So we've become the planet's thermostat in that sense. As to the partisan nature of all of this, I'm afraid that as part of the general polarization of American politics, this is one of the, it's somehow become an article of the true faith among the GOP to deny climate change. And Mitt Romney has now been forced to do it, though earlier he was much more open on these things. In Massachusetts, he started down the path of some mild regulation of carbon. Now he says, oh, the scientists will tell us in 50 years whether this is a problem or not, which is nonsense of the highest order. There are conservatives, as one would expect, outside the kind of political life who are understanding that, you know, that in any real meaning of the term conservative, what I'm talking about is deeply conservative. We would like to keep the world in something like the shape that it was in when we were born onto it. And so you find in faith communities of all kinds deep receptivity to this challenge. And one of the other places you find it is in the Pentagon, where people are assessing what threats they see in the century ahead and coming to the conclusion that high, if not highest, on the list is the kind of destabilization that comes with the world going through chaotic physical change. That's not yet reflected in our electoral politics, mostly because our electoral politics are driven so much by money, and the biggest source of that money in now for many people is precisely this industry. I mean, the Koch brothers, who are the third and fourth richest people in the country, and have announced they're going to spend tens of millions of dollars on the next election. They're already spending it, and they're doing it right around these issues, trying to demonize anyone who would question whether or not it's time to move away from reliance on the thing they sell, coal and gas and oil.
Now, you mentioned the instability of a world where the effects of climate change are in full swing. And I know there's a piece in the Global Warming Reader by Peter Schwartz and Doug Randall where they talk about that link between the Earth's carrying capacity and warfare. So what is that relationship between an overburdened environment and national security?
Just start thinking about all the things that happen as you begin to. So you get higher food prices and more people going hungry. That leads to a certain kind of instability right there. But then add in the fact that you have increasing crop failures and you have rising oceans. Much of the world's agriculture is right along the coasts, rice agriculture in the tropics, things like that, in places that are already under stress as ocean levels start to rise. I mean, we're losing farmland, you know, and you add in drought and flood, and what you have is a lot of people on the move. To the degree that you can model this on a computer, the experts think that we'll have far more refugees in the course of this century than we did in the very bloody century we just came through. And refugees are one of the greatest sources of instability there is. I mean, think about a country like Bangladesh. There's a lot of people there, 140 or 50 million, and they're sort of, you know, like trapped almost. The Indians have just finished building a long, high wall between Bangladesh and India because they can guess what the result of that is going to be, and because there's not a lot of spare real estate in India to absorb huge influxes of people from somewhere else. You know, the same kind of thing going on in one place after another. So the scenarios, the planners at places like the Pentagon can spin out an almost endless number of scenarios, some of which we're beginning to see come true about just this kind of instability. There's a fascinating piece a few weeks ago in some place, New York or someplace, about how the ongoing drought in Syria played a serious role in as one of the contributing factors to this deep unrest we're seeing there at the moment, and in a larger sense around the Mideast, which is the most water-stressed place on the planet, and something that adds and sometimes leads the general instability there.
Bill McKibben, our guest this hour. He is the author of the first book for a general audience about global warming. It was called The End of Nature. Foreign Policy magazine named him one of the 100 most important global thinkers. And he's edited a new book, and it's called The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change. And we want to know what you think, your questions and your comments for Bill McKibben this hour. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with one of our country's leading environmentalists, Bill McKibben, our guest this hour, who recently edited The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change. And let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Chris joining us in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. Real pleasure to be here talking to Bill McKibben. I really respect his work. I do agree that we have a lot of concern with global warming, and I think the science is advanced enough to attribute a lot of that warming to greenhouse gases. And obviously it's a concern that the CO2 could be in the lithosphere and ocean system for thousands of years, creating problems for generations for thousands of years. However, I'd like to caution that tying individual weather events such as this last March's heat wave or other cold events like Snowmageddon to make a position for or against global warming is very risky and could do damage. I don't think the science is advanced enough to tie individual events. Yeah, it's reasonable that as the climate changes, we do risk more extreme weather events such as heavy rain and so forth. But I get a little nervous when we tie individual weather events to climate change. And I wonder if that would damage the overall message and reliability of those of us trying to push awareness in the climate change.
All right. Thanks, Chris. What do you think about that, Bill McKibben?
Well, I think it's a good point. The way to talk about it always is in terms of odds. There was just a new paper published last week looking at what scientists have started calling kind of the climate dice. And what they are saying is as temperatures rise, the odds of the kind of event that we're seeing become far, far, far more likely. So what this paper said was that the hot extremes you see at any given moment, that the distribution of seasonal mean temperature anomalies has shifted towards higher temperature and the range of anomalies has increased. So the hot extreme, which historically covered much less than 1% of the Earth's land surface at any given moment, now covers something like 10%. And so they say in this new paper, we conclude that extreme heat waves such as that in Texas and Oklahoma in 2011, say, or Moscow in 2010, were, quote, caused, unquote, by global warming because their likelihood was negligible prior to the recent rapid global warming. That is, you could have one, but the odds were vanishingly small. What's happening now is that we see these kind of events become far more likely. The 100-year storm, you know, the kind of gauge that planners have always used to build bridges and culverts and things. What's the worst storm you can have in 100 years? That 100-year storm now comes every few years in a lot of places. And so people are going about the very expensive and difficult job of making bridges longer and making every culvert bigger and trying somehow to stay ahead of this curve. You can't say with some absolute confidence that it was impossible that this, you know, we set 17,000 records last month for new high temperatures because the planet had warmed, but you can say with a kind of remarkable certainty that this is just what climatologists have told us will happen, and now we can see it in operation around us.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Chris. And this is an email from Simon in Wisconsin Rapids who writes, sea level rise resulting from climate change is going to be the biggest challenge of the next 100 years. And echoing something that we've heard from the former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, who's got a piece in your book, too. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think sea level rise is it happens slightly slower than some of these terrestrial effects. But in many ways, it has, well, it certainly has great globe-shaping power. You can now go on Google Earth and places and see apps that people have built to show what happens in cities around the world as the sea level rises 1 meter or 2 meters or 3 meters. And what happens is so expensive that there's not enough money on Earth to sort of begin to deal with it. Because our civilization arose in the Holocene, it arose... everything is built to the sea levels we've had for 10,000 years and the river flows we've had for 10,000 years and the floodplains that we've had for 10,000 years. And as the world moves to some new state and does it very quickly and chaotically, it's going to be extremely difficult to keep up with it. And in some places, obviously, utterly impossible, the Maldives being a good example. That's a 5,000-year-old culture there, and those islands that span the equator and the Indian Ocean. But the odds that it'll be a 5,100-year-old culture are slim because the highest point in the whole archipelago is only a meter or two above sea level. They put aside money in their budget to buy a new homeland someday. The only problem is, where do you buy a new homeland?
Yeah.
South Asia is not really bulging with vacant real estate.
And I read at some point that most of the people there said they actually didn't want to move. They were just kind of going to go down with the ship.
I mean, you know, who wants to leave the place they love? Especially if you've ever been to the Maldives, it really is pretty much paradise.
Yeah, it looks
and
stunning.
And it would be a great shame to have to. But, you know, if someone told me that I was going to have to leave Vermont in my lifetime because of the change in the weather, I'd be angry, sad, in denial, all the things that human beings get. The Maldives, you know, people there have been among our biggest helpers at 350.org, and they're very, very engaged in solidarity with people around the world, which is awfully generous of them since they've done absolutely nothing to cause this problem.
Well, so we're talking about global warming. I have to ask you about the polar bears because they have been the face of global warming from the early days. And a while ago, I was talking with a climatologist friend, and he said even if we turn things around, the polar bears are already gone. Give us an update on the polar bears.
I don't really know how it will all end. I think actually there's a new paper in the last couple of weeks, maybe this is a bit of good news, saying that polar bears seem more genetically linked to other bears, brown bears, than people had thought, and that it's possible that they've sort of survived, although in very small numbers, periods of ice retreat and things in the past. Bears are, in my experience, and I've, you know, where I live, there are some, bears are pretty smart creatures. And there may be, they may be, who knows, maybe they can adapt fast enough that some remnant of that population will exist south in the south, and not, but they won't be doing what polar bears are doing at the moment, you know, hunting seals on sea ice. So polar bears, as we know them, you know, I think the future is pretty bleak. The future is pretty bleak for a lot of the DNA on this Earth. The scientists have said that a rapid global warming will be like, you know, the last time a big asteroid hit the planet in terms of its effect on extinction. The only difference is this time the asteroid is us, and it doesn't have to hit. We can still take action to slow down and absorb this blow, but boy, we better take it soon. Instead, we're just sticking our foot on the pedal and accelerating.
Well, so I was thinking about how to talk to my children about climate change and what I'm going to tell them about the polar bears. You've got a daughter. How do you talk to your daughter about what's happening?
I think I think the first thing is, for a certain age, don't talk to them about it. The first job of parents is to get kids to fall in love with the natural world. And it's very hard to fall in love with something that you've just been told is going to die. Most of us don't choose our friends from among the terminally ill, you know, because it's too painful. But past a certain age, it's very appropriate to be talking about it, but only in the context of doing something about it. You've got to give kids the feeling that there's something real, and not just changing their light bulbs, although that's nice, but also getting engaged in a bigger way. So this thing on May 5th, this Connect the Dots Day, is a perfect example. You know, take your kids down to the farmer's market at the state capitol or to all the other things that are going on, and then when they go home, go to 350.org or climatedots.org and watch the pictures roll in from around the planet, and that'll give them the sense that they are a part of a movement that's rising up, that adults are actually trying to take care of this problem, that they are working with young people who've really been in the lead in many ways to try and prevent this thing from happening. And if you do that, then they feel empowered, not completely terrified by the whole thing.
And this is a good time to say that we'll have a lot of the links to the things you're talking about up on our Facebook page, including a wonderful website that a listener sent in, which tells stories from around Wisconsin about the climate and the effects of climate change. So that's on our Facebook page, too, at The Veronica Rickert Show. And I think we've got time for one or two more calls. Let's go to Nate joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hey, thanks for having me. I have a point and a comment, or a question and a comment. First would be, I'm in a discussion with a global warming denier, and I was hoping you'd be able to give me a pointer as to where to look for empirical research stuff that we've already recorded with graphs and probably written in plain English, but with links and references so that if we want to go into the details that made it, we can.
Sure.
The second thing is, sorry to just butt the second in, but it is a good point, I think. In political speak, there's this term floating around, crony capitalism, in that supposedly the government is propping up green energy or shielding green energy from the real free market. And I would like to point out that if we are protecting fossil fuel-related industries from the damage that their pollution causes through global warming, and perhaps they are the actual crony capitalists.
Oh, absolutely. So let me
first give them a bill.
Answer to the first question is, go to, there's a wonderful environmental online journal called grist.org, and they have a section called How to Speak to a Climate Skeptic. And it'll go through each of the arguments and provide all the graphs and charts you could ever want. Also, remind your friend that it's not just scientists. At this point, the part of our economy that we ask to analyze risk, the insurance industry, is flashing the same red lights. As to crony capitalism, you know, people get bent out of shape about the Solyndra and, you know, subsidizing a failed solar power company. I mean, you know, that is not a happy moment, but that's, you take a certain number of risks when you're trying to help new technology get off the ground. The real scandal is that 200 years after we learned to burn coal and oil, we're still subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, and with many multiples of the amount of money that go to renewable energy. Bernie Sanders will introduce a bill in a week or so that identifies $20 billion in the federal budget in subsidies to the richest industry on Earth. I'm almost certain we can find something better to do with that $20 billion than hand it over to Exxon year after year after year after year. These guys are the crony capitalists of all time, and the biggest subsidy of all is the one you correctly identify. They're allowed to pour their waste out for free.
They and, Bill, I'm sorry, we've got to leave it there. We are out of time.
A good place to leave it. Many thanks, Veronica, for an interesting talk.
Well, many thanks to you. It was great to have you on. Appreciate your time this morning.
God bless. Take care.
Bill McKibben, our guest this hour, one of the country's leading environmentalists, and he edited a new book called The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change, which was published at the end of March. Again, check out our Facebook page for links and other information about the discussion today. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, and Rhonda Fanning and Rob Ferret. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.